If no one had stayed up past midnight, there might not be a Peace Corps. I want to take that thought with you this morning, that a great nation would send its youth, its people, abroad, not to extend its power, not to intimidate its enemies or to kill or to be killed, but to build and to dig and to teach and to grow and to make a difference in the world, is one of the most radical ideas we've ever seen, certainly in the 20th century. It's not the kind of idea that comes out of subcommittees or a board meeting or whatever might have been the 1960 equivalent of a PowerPoint or a plan that might be developed on the websites. Rather, the idea began behind the Peace Corps is the kind you stumble on in the wee hours of the morning after your third cup of coffee when all the conventional business of the day has been set aside in many ways. And that's the uniqueness of the idea that we inherited, those of us who are here today. Most of us here have lived with it for the whole length of our adult lives until it stopped seeming so unique. But if I can restore its outrageousness just a bit this morning, if I can remind all of you here this morning of the surprise that you felt, as I felt, the first time you heard of such a thing called the Peace Corps, and that the world's most powerful nation was paying good money for it, I think we'll have done a job, in a sense, of reminding where we need to go. So let's start with this fact. The Peace Corps was born at 2 in the morning on October 14, 1960. John F. Kennedy, who was hours late for campaign stop at the University of Michigan, as we all know, he guessed that the crowd, most of it had gone home by that time, but when he drove up to the student union on that campus, he found them waiting in droves. 10,000 students had stayed up till the wee hours of the morning in the cold to hear him speak. Now, I know something about campaigning after the last couple of years on national level, and the stories are true. It's exhausting. You can only imagine from personal experience how he must have felt. Monday night, staying up wee hours in the morning, bad food, uncomfortable beds. The last thing you want to do at 2 or 3 in the morning is to give some speech with a new idea. So the temptation must have been overwhelming to give the Michigan students a thank you for coming out and then recite a few lines from memory and then send them back to their dorm rooms. But at some point, whether it was when he first began making his way to that enormous crowd that early morning hours, or it was when the 10,000 of them began to chant his name when he climbed the steps of the student union, I suspect Senator Kennedy realized that there was something special about that moment, and he realized he owed them something a bit more than just a thank you and some memorized lines. And what he gave them was a direct challenge, as we all know. How many of you are going to be doctors, are willing to spend your days in Ghana, technicians or engineers? How many of you are willing to work in the Foreign Service and spend your lives traveling around the world? I believe that the challenge is our Peace Corps' founding, that challenge is our Peace Corps' founding document. And it's a fitting one. We didn't get our start with a white paper or a vetted speech, a campaign commercial. In fact, we didn't get our start with a statement of any kind. It began with a question. Showing up for a candidate is one thing, but how many of you will take that dedication and use it to repair the world? That was the question. But if you had asked the next day, the odds were good that it was going to stay a question and nothing more. That it was going to denigrate from a powerful challenge to merely a nice, forgettable line. John Kennedy didn't have an organization in mind, didn't have any funding in mind, in fact, didn't even have a name for it when he talked about that early morning. In the early going, he only had one thing. It was a petition. It was drafted by Michigan students a few days after President Kennedy asked his question. And its answer was an emphatic yes. It circulated at colleges all over the state, and by the time its sponsors were ready to present it to John Kennedy in person, it had grown to several scrolls bearing thousands and thousands and thousands of names. Just days before the election, they handed over to President Kennedy this scroll. He paused and grinned, and as Harris Wofford has pointed out, he said to him, "You need this back, don't you?" As Harris has pointed out, those were the days before Xerox machines, and so the students hadn't had time to copy down all the names they had. But JFK didn't need any more proof. Letters answering his challenge were flooding his headquarters, and soon there were 30,000 that arrived answering that challenge made in the steps of the University of Michigan. But then his top advisors were working on a plan in earnest. By then his plans were working in earnest, and soon it was rolled out. They didn't rely on Senator Kennedy's unscripted call to service. They made the case for a Peace Corps in the hard language of realpolitik. In his first political speech on the Peace Corps, one idea was dominant, the Russians. If we didn't start doing our part for the developing world, the communists would. So the Peace Corps found its place in the realities of the Cold War as well. just as it is finding a place now in the uncertain world of this new century, when we face conflicts with people who know little of America as we know of them. But the idea that service could be a tool of foreign policy, even in some ways a weapon of war, if you will, was radical in itself. It says that there's more measures of strength than caliber or tonnage or blast radius. It says that the world needs to see our ideals, not just in ink, but in incarnate, and the young men and women, people who endure with their dirty hands, who work in the sun beside you in the fields or villages or urban settings all over the world. It says that you can only hate America if you don't know America. And the idea took shape because of a few thousand students who knew their moment when they saw it, and because John Kennedy's campaign had the nimbleness and the imagination to seize on it. Sergeant Shriver wrote that the Peace Corps would probably still be just an idea, but for the affirmative response of those Michigan students and the faculty, it was almost a case of spontaneous combustion, as Sarge has said. If the Peace Corps were a movie, it might end then and there. You can imagine JFK's call being triumphantly answered, the credits roll, streams of young volunteers shipping off the next day. But even the most revolutionary of ideas have a way of coming back down to earth, of course. Even as President Kennedy moved to make the Peace Corps a centerpiece of his administration, the criticism began. Richard Nixon called it a haven for draft dodgers. Dwight Eisenhower called it a juvenile experiment. And in a way, the blanket criticism like that was the easiest to deal with. Far more dangerous was the criticism from the inside, the kind that came from the foreign policy hands who responded, in essence, "What a wonderful idea, but keep it small." Because a strong consensus was forming among academics and State Department experts, proceed cautiously, start with a small pilot project. Don't make mistakes. Limit the program to 1,000 or 2,000 for a beginning. Don't let this experiment get out of hand. Some thought that the number of volunteers should be no more than 500. They spoke convincingly about minimizing the risks, guarding our reputation, and avoiding a fiasco. And if they'd gotten their way, serving in the Peace Corps would be, to coin a phrase, safe, legal, and rare, I suppose. The fact that it isn't, the fact that many of us are here this morning at all, is due to another late-night moment of inspiration. And hence the point, this all began in the wee hours of the morning. It happened at the Peace Corps' first official headquarters, a hotel room here in Washington. At that point, the staff of the Peace Corps totaled two. One of them's here today. Two Kennedy aides, a guy named Sergeant Shriver and a guy named Harris Wofford, holed up in a hotel room with stacks of paper and a few typewriters, trying to figure out how to put this outrageous idea into practice. But despite regular calls from the White House asking what was going on, why was it taking so long, this is in February, by the way, of 1961, about 3 weeks after the inauguration, they hadn't figured out the name yet, even for this organization. What Shriver did know, as he later told us, was that he couldn't stand the cautious, conventional approach that was in vogue. He knew that America would only have one chance to get this right, and he needed the intellectual ammunition to prove it. He found it at 3 in the morning, halfway through a stack of letters and memos that arrived in that hotel room. Someone had wanted him to read a short paper by a man named Warren Wiggins, a mid-level employee at the State Department. The paper was called The Towering Task, and it took its name for a line in JFK's first State of the Union address. "The problems are towering and unprecedented, and the response must be towering and unprecedented as well." Wiggins was proposing that the Peace Corps be just such a huge endeavor. He began by methodically tearing down the case for a small, cautious Peace Corps. First, a tiny commitment wouldn't be enough to win their support in Congress, he thought. He wrote the imaginary reaction of a foreign ambassador asked to host about 100 American volunteers. One, what can 100 people do? What will Washington think of next? Number three, we have too many Americans here in this country already. Number four, what a terrible chance we're taking with all these kids roaming all over our country. In other words, 100 young people was a nuisance. But multiply that nuisance by 50, and the equation changes entirely. As Wiggins wrote, 100 youths engaged in agricultural work of some sort in Brazil might pass unnoticed, except for the problems involved. But 5,000 American youths helping to build Brasilia might warrant the full attention and support of the president of Brazil himself, end of quote. But if a tiny Peace Corps would do next to nothing for the host country, it would do even less for our own country. The tremendous student response to JFK's question was still fresh in everyone's mind. But if the plan for caution was taken seriously, it meant that only two or three graduates from every college would ever have the chance of serving. And if, after inspiring a generation with talk of towering problems and torches being passed to a new generation, Kennedy announced nothing more than a stripped-down, underfunded bureaucracy, it would be nothing less than hypocrisy. Instead, Warren Wiggins concluded the Peace Corps needed to begin with a quantum jump. It needed to begin immediately by executive order with 5,000 to 10,000 volunteers and the potential to grow to as many as 100,000. The idea hit Sergeant Shriver like lightning. He fired off a telegram, and within 6 hours, Warren Wiggins had arrived at the hotel and was working on a report for the president. Within a month, President Kennedy had created the Peace Corps by executive order. Within 2 years, more than 7,000 young Americans were serving abroad, and by the year I joined, 15,000 were working all over the world. One of them, of course, was a dark-haired, 22-year-old English major from Providence College, who arrived in the small village of Benito Moncion of the Dominican Republic. Without much Spanish or the faintest idea of what I was doing, quite candidly, without a clue that more than 40 years later, I'd be standing in the capital of the United States as the chairman of the subcommittee dealing with the Peace Corps in Latin America, telling you that the Peace Corps gave him the richest 2 years of his life. I owe those years and the shape of all the years after which they molded so much to John Kennedy and that unscripted 2 a.m. question, and to Warren Wiggins and his unpretentious 3 a.m. paper. From this story, which above all else is a story of spontaneity and government working at its best, and the remarkable things that happen when leaders really listen, I think we can draw two lessons, if you will. First, size matters. The perils of a small, timid Peace Corps are just as clear today as they were in 1961. Just as then, advocates of a stripped-down mission make the same arguments. Sending untrained, untested young people only aggravates our host countries and raises the chance of a mishap. So let's send a few experts instead. And just as in 1961, our response is fundamentally the same and fundamentally correct. Of course, we need volunteers of the highest quality, but we need the highest quantities too. Every American of goodwill we send abroad is another chance to make America known to the world that often fears and suspects us. And every American who returns from that service is a gift to our country, a citizen who strengthens us with firsthand knowledge of this ever-shrinking world in which we live. As Sergeant Shriver said, Peace Corps volunteers come home to the USA realizing that there are billions, yes, the only sergeant to talk about billions, billions and billions, he would say, of human beings not enraptured by our pretensions or our practices or even our standards of conduct. President Kennedy predicted that within a few decades, we'd have more than 1 million returned volunteers. They'd add immeasurably to our debates and on foreign policy. They'd be a formidable voting bloc, calling leaders to account when they neglect the world in which we live. But despite a promising start, we're far short of President Kennedy's goal. Today, there are fewer than 200,000 of us who have returned after more than a half a century of this program being in place. For the sake of the world's understanding of America and America's understanding of the world, we have a lot of catching up to do, in my view. I say that we should double the Peace Corps and hope that we will in the coming days. But there's a second lesson to this story that I've told. Size matters, but it comes at a cost. The bigger any organization grows, the slower it gets. The Peace Corps that charted its course in a hotel room with a staff of two enjoys a staff of thousands today in a wonderful building not far from the White House. And that's all to the good. The Peace Corps couldn't act on the dramatic scale that we want it to act on without all the apparatus behind it. Even the most groundbreaking of ideas must all make in good time what the philosopher Gramsci once called the long march through the institutions. But there wouldn't be a Peace Corps if John Kennedy had stuck to the script in Ann Arbor. There wouldn't be a Peace Corps if thousands of students acting on their own initiative hadn't caught his attention with their movement. There might not be a Peace Corps if Sarge Shriver had listened to the respectable voices of caution. Virtually alone among all of our organs of government, the Peace Corps is unique for its grassroots origin. So as we grow the Peace Corps, as we get it the volunteers it needs and the increased funding it deserves, we must respect its roots. And if we do, then I think we make a stronger case for the very argument of growing this wonderful organization. We must work to make it more decentralized, because service at its best is personal and spontaneous. And because volunteers know far more about conditions on the ground than many of us do here in Washington or ever will. We can start that transformation today. In the Senate, I've introduced a Peace Corps piece of legislation that gives volunteers more initiative, and more responsibility. We can set aside a portion of the annual Peace Corps budget as seed monies. Volunteers can use the money for demonstration projects in their host countries or for a third goal, projects at home, to promote understanding of the world in which we live. We can encourage volunteers to take advantage of the private sector by authorizing them to accept, under very carefully defined circumstances, donations to support their projects in the countries where they're working. We can bring the Peace Corps into the digital age by establishing websites and email links for use by volunteers in country. And finally, we need to bring more volunteers into the decision-making process. They should have more input in staffing decisions, site selection, language training, and country programs. So we ought to work to make the Peace Corps bigger and more decentralized, and at the same time, I believe we can, at the same time, extend its worldwide reach and honor its grassroots past. Doing both is the best way to be true to the spirit that created this remarkable organization, the spirit that turned student activism into government action, that combined Cold War diplomacy with the spontaneous need to serve. Warren Wiggins died last year at the age of 84, this man who wrote that 3 a.m., that memo that Sarge read at 3 a.m. in the morning. And it was a line in his obituary that sums up the spirit behind our Peace Corps better than anything I can think of. Harris, you were quoted in that obituary that morning, and I want to quote the line that you used that I read the other day that he captures, in a sense, what we're talking about here. Harris said in that obituary about Warren Wiggins, he said, "I think he embodied the watchwords that were once given to me. We must be more inventive if we're going to do our duty. Inventiveness and duty. They're qualities that don't often go together. We don't think of them coming together. Duty can stifle imaginations and creativity. In turn, can take us far afield from what we, in fact, in creativity, in turn, can take us far afield from what we owe to others. Putting our creativity in the full service of our duty, it is one of the most difficult tasks there is, but it can be done, and when it is, great things can be achieved." The Peace Corps is proof, I think, of that very, very point. Today we honor it and pledge ourselves to keep it young, because it's done so much to keep us young ourselves. We're blessed to have had it in our lives. It's made a difference to each and every one of us, and a remarkable difference for the world and the country which we call home. And thanks for listening.